For the week of September 17th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 381, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Hello, Sperling.
Hi, how are you? Back in New York City.
I am getting ready for the New York Film Festival. The screenings start today, assuming I can get away after our podcast in time to catch the Joan Didion documentary. I'm excited. I'm ready for the next few weeks, but you will not be around next week, will you?
No, I will be going to Expo Cine in Brazil.
And you just don't think they have Wi-Fi in Brazil? How insulting.
Well, no. It's, you know, I'm there to work and to cover the event and to work at the event. So, you know what? I just, you know, there's a four-hour time difference, so...
What work is more important than our listeners of Showbiz Sandbox?
You know, it's going to be a very busy week. It's going to be. I knew you were going to do this as soon as we started, so I should have probably come up with something better to say. Expo Cine. It's the largest Latin American trade show for movie theater owners and distributors in South America, Central America, Mexico. People from all over the world come. Actually,
will you go to South Park when you're in South America? Or is that not how that works?
I don't think South Park is actually in South America. I do believe it's in Colorado, however.
Oh, okay. Well, they had a fun season opener. They did what we did. You know, they're sort of doing an homage to Showbiz Sandbox because we have messed up people's Alexas every once in a while. Sorry for that. And they did their season premiere and they played with Amazon Echo and Alexa and all that to and triggered that all over the country, all throughout the show, actually. It was kind of funny.
Yes. I mean, we can't, you know, we're a family show. We can't repeat some of the things they said to put on people's shopping lists. But it was very funny.
And so they obviously listen to our show. And if they listen to our show this week, hey, Trey and Matt, what will they be hearing about?
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll look at the Emmy Awards, the winners, the losers, the White House lackeys treated like conquering heroes or at least good sports. Who said Hollywood was liberal? During our book filter segment, Michael will tell you a surefire way to win an Oscar. Option a book about a park bench. I'm interested to hear about that. On Inside Baseball, we'll catch up with our special guest, Ann Thompson, the editor-at-large over at IndieWire. She's been traveling the globe attending film festivals, and we'll get the inside scoop on Oscar hopefuls and the state of the film industry as it heads into award season. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from everywhere, including, of course, Abbott and Costello. So who's on first? What's on second? I don't know who's on third. All right.
Okay. That's a reference to last week's episode. So if you haven't heard last week's episode, please go. Feel free to listen.
Our dream of vaudeville has died.
Correct.
But the dream of Pennywise the Clown continues on. Stephen King keeps dreaming and scaring people with his novels. And the number one movie around the world is, in fact, It, the horror film. $120 million on the weekend, $370 million worldwide. More records were set. It's about to become the highest grossing horror film of all time in North America, without adjusting for inflation. It's the highest grossing film ever released in September after just two weekends. It's at $220 million, and it's already the biggest film ever released in September. That's kind of amazing.
And to put it into further perspective, as Jim Amos did over at Celluloid Junkie, shameless plug, he said that it would be the second weekend alone at 60-some-odd million dollars in North America would be the biggest September opening. Even without the first weekend, it would be the biggest September debut ever.
Oh, that's interesting. So it has passed Crocodile Dundee as the biggest September release ever. It's also going to pass The Exorcist, which I've seen listed at either $230 million or $202 million domestic gross. That's just North America here. And of course, that's unadjusted for inflation. And it doesn't count, for example, maybe The Sixth Sense as a horror film. That's more of a suspense supernatural thriller, I guess. That movie grossed about $300 million. So you know what? It is going to pass that as well. But The Exorcist, that made a lot of money, and that was a long time ago. If you adjust for inflation, that grossed about $1.1 billion in today's terms. Now, that's a lot of money. That's Star Wars territory. It sold about 112 million tickets back then in 1973, I think. And, you know, that's if you translate that in today's terms, yeah, it would have to gross $1 billion domestically to pretty much sell as many tickets as The Exorcist did all the way back then.
Think about that. So, at that time, that's like 50% or more of the U.S. population seeing that film.
Yeah, good way to put that in perspective. And if you look at Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and see that, think of that as a hit, you know what? That sold probably about 200 million tickets. So that's big bucks no matter what era you're living in. So, you know, it is a big success story. The Exorcist was a big success story back then, and the hits keep coming for the box office, all right? After a horrible summer, suddenly September is off to a roaring start, and everyone's saying, wow, we're catching up with last year, and we could set an all-time record. How quickly we forget. At number two around the world is War for the Planet of the Apes, $63 million on the weekend, and it's just about to hit $450 million worldwide. That's about triple the budget of War for the Planet of the Apes. What does that mean by our very rough metric?
Well, that means that it probably is about to break even.
Yeah, no, it's a hit. There's, you know, it's tripled its budget, and all things being standard and typical, we're going to say, yeah, this movie's a hit right off the bat. You know, movies can make money even if they don't triple their budget at the box office for a lot of factors, because there's a lot of money to be made down the road. But this movie is a clear-cut hit. And that means one more film from the summer of 2017 moves into the win column.
Well, let me ask you this. Is War of the Planet of the Apes did it basically jump up to number two here because of China? If so...
Absolutely.
Then you have to say, well, you know what? You have to be very careful about saying it's tripled its budget, because remember, whatever it made this week worldwide, $63 million, you might not be seeing most of that.
That's true of every film. You know, every film makes money in China, so it depends on how much they made in China. We take that into account. That's why we say a movie has to at least triple it, and it's not done yet. It made $60 million this weekend. Who knows what it'll make next weekend and the weekend after that? It could hit $500 million. The fact is, by our very rough metric, we're going to stamp this film as a success story right off the bat. And we know down the road, with the good reviews it had, cable, video on demand, Blu-ray, worldwide markets, you know, it's going to make money.
Oh, yeah,
and that means
absolutely.
That means there are only five flops from the summer, and one of them was from the French. And they're pretty well distributed. One flop came for Disney. That was Cars 3. One flop was from Warner Brothers. That was King Arthur. One flop came from Sony. That was The Dark Tower. And that only cost $60 million to make. And one flop came from Fox, which was Alien Covenant. And that wasn't even that much of a flop either. So the flops were well distributed. A couple of them have pretty good stories to tell, like Cars 3 and Alien Covenant. So you know what? This summer, that was such a disaster, we just got another win.
Well, what I would say is, rather than flop, they're disappointments. Cars 3, you hope, makes $500 million.
That's a flop. I mean, that's a flop. I mean, it cost $175 million to make, and it's at...
$350.
Yeah, that's an absolute flop. I mean, King Arthur was a dog. Everybody knew it. That's why it sat on the shelf.
Oh, no. I'm talking only about Alien Covenant and Cars 3.
Yeah. Well, Cars 3, the asterisk there is simply that they've got a massive toy line, and while the movie is unquestionably a flop... they're probably buttressing up, you know, $1 billion in sales on toys, and that can't be discounted. It's not a good story for the movie, but there's an argument to be made that it's not the worst flood of red ink that they'll ever see.
No, not at all. If anything, they're keeping the franchise alive and boosting up, attendance at their theme parks in Cars Land, which is one of the more popular attractions over at California Adventureland. So absolutely, this is not a loss. If they break, I think we've talked about this, if they break even on Cars 3, they'll be doing just fine.
Well, they won't. It looks like it's pretty much done. It's already opened in China, so I don't think there are any big markets left. It's absolutely a flop. But again, there are caveats to be made. And the point is that when you compare summer to summer, what really matters is individual movies, their individual budget, and how much they gross worldwide. At number three is a movie that hopes to gross a lot worldwide. It's called American Assassin, starring Michael Keaton, $21 million on its opening weekend. And number four is Spider-Man Homecoming, which had a great opening in China, and then it fell hard, like 70%. People were like, they weren't so excited by Spidey, I guess. But it did gross another $17 million, and it's going to hit $900 million worldwide, most of it in territories outside China. So there, Sperling. At number five is one of the big stories of the week. It's Mother, lowercase m, exclamation point, Mother. It's from Darren Aronofsky and Jennifer Lawrence. It grossed $13 million on the weekend, and it is clearly one of the most pilloried, hated films of the year.
Wait, what? Are you serious?
It got an F on CinemaScore. Only about 12 films in history have had an F on CinemaScore.
Oh, okay.
Mother has been despised and rejected by audiences. It is the lowest grossing opener for a Jennifer Lawrence film ever. It is hated by the audiences. If you go to Rotten Tomatoes and look at all critics, they gave it a pretty measly 69%. And if you go to Top Critics, they actually liked it most of anyone. So the hoity-toity big critics give it a 76%. And frankly, if you're not looking at individual reviews, anything under 90 on Rotten Tomatoes should give you a warning sign. So the top critics liked it the most, but not that much. The big group of critics, all of the critics, liked it less. And the actual people who go to movies and buy tickets, they hated this film, hated it.
Yeah, and the few reviews that I read and or heard, because sometimes I hear them on the radio, I know, I still listen. But they all said the same thing. They said audiences, they're going to be divided, if not absolutely loathe this film. And they said, look, as much as we thought it was wacky and absolutely out there, we could see people hating this movie.
Well, our in-house critic, Aaron Rich, said, without exaggeration, it may be the worst film he's ever seen.
Really?
And I would say he and I went to see Birdemic, so that's saying something.
Well, I have to say, when I saw the ads for this film and the trailer, I went, wait, Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem, they do not look like a couple at all.
You're racist.
No, I just mean like he's probably in his late 40s, okay? And she's like 25. They just don't.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah, I don't know.
And number six is the Tom Cruise film American Made, another $12 million as it waits to open up here in the U.S. That's at $50 million worldwide.
So that film should be called American Made, not American Released.
It will be soon. At number seven is The Hitman's Bodyguard. That's at $140 million worldwide. Dunkirk is well past the $500 million mark. It's doing great. Annabelle Creation, another horror film, that's going to hit $300 million in a few days. And there's Cars 3 that we were talking about before, $356 million worldwide. It's still playing in 19 territories, but I'm pretty sure it's all played out. I don't think there are any major territories left for that one. Here's a new movie, however. It's called Sword Art Online, the movie, Ordinal Scale. Okay, that gets a little confusing, so let me explain. Sword Art Online is a series of mangas. They're called light novels, meaning they're sort of not heavy duty. And they are set in a massively multiplayer online game where people get trapped, a la Tron. That was turned into an anime TV series, and that, after two seasons, has now been turned into a feature film. So it's a continuation of the story. This weekend, it opened up in a new territory and grossed $6 million. It's at $31 million worldwide. And if you are interested, you've got a lot of catching up to do.
So let me get this straight. It's a book wrapped in a video game, wrapped in a television show, wrapped in a movie.
Well, yes, I forgot to mention that. It was a manga turned into a TV series, and that spun off an actual video game, naturally, since it is based on a video game. So yeah, it is also now a genuine video game as well, and now a feature film. There may even be a season three.
Okay.
And number 12 is The Emoji Movie. There won't be a sequel to this one. Sad face. $5 million on the weekend, $180 million worldwide. Reese Witherspoon had a great night at the Emmys, thanks to her win with Best Miniseries. But her movie Home Again, not so good. $5 million on the weekend, that's at $20 million worldwide. And looking at Reese's track record, she is not a big draw overseas. Most of her movies have done less, perhaps substantially less, in international markets. Perhaps because of the nature of the romantic comedies, I don't know, but she has not proven a big draw. With a few rare exceptions, all her movies have grossed less in the rest of the world than they have in North America.
She needs to do an action film. Less talking, more running.
She did. That was actually the big success story for her. That's the one of two or three movies that have actually grossed more money overseas. That's the film she co-starred with Chris Pine and Tom Hardy and was arguably not the biggest draw. You know, it was more the action and the dudes fighting for her attention. But that one movie, what was it called?
This Means War?
Yes, This Means War. That movie is one of the exceptions to the rule for Reese Witherspoon, an actress who I like. Baby Driver's at $220 million worldwide. Skipping down, here's another new movie, Invisible Guest. This is a Spanish thriller, sort of set in the courtroom. It grossed $5 million on the weekend, and I guess it opened up on a Wednesday because it's at $10 million worldwide. Right below that is Victoria and Abdul, a new period costumer starring Judi Dench, an ode to colonialism. I'm going to see it in a day or two. It grossed $4.7 million in 10 different territories. I know it opened up in the UK, but I'm not sure where else it opened up. If you've seen the movie in your country, let us know where it's playing and what you thought about it. How can they do that, Sperling?
Well, they can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And you can reach out to us either on Twitter or Facebook, and we usually respond pretty quickly.
That's right. And looking at the box office, when we say a movie that triples its budget is probably a success story, that's really a symbolic thing because we don't know the deals that were made. Some movies are owned worldwide by one company. Other movies make or lose money territory to territory. That's probably the case for Logan Lucky. We're told it costs about $30 million to make, but given the big names involved, I think it's safe to say they sold off this movie in the rest of the world and made their money back before it ever a single ticket was sold. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. I would not be shocked if they made maybe at least half, if not more. And I certainly wouldn't be shocked if you told me that they had sold off all the rights. I'd go, oh, okay, yeah, all right. They broke even before the movie was released. If you said, look, you know what, they made the 3/4 of the money back beforehand, they sold off 3/4 of the budget. Okay, fine. That's also believable.
Oh, I would think they could get $30 million worldwide for, 80, 90 territories.
Yeah,
I mean,
probably.
That doesn't seem a hard get at all, given the big names involved. So I'm pretty confident that they were smart.
Although it is about NASCAR. That's the rub there, is that it's not about a sport.
It's about a heist. It's about a robbery. That's how they sold it. They didn't sell it as being about NASCAR. They sold it as being about a robbery.
Yeah.
They said it's from the guys of Ocean's 11. They're pulling off a heist. They didn't say sports, So I think that's an easier sell, especially with the big names involved. So again, this movie has grossed $38 million worldwide. It's made about $30 million in North America. It's already made $11 million overseas. So maybe the people in those territories that bought it will be okay. We'll have to see when all is said and done. It will vary territory to territory. And it is a comedy. Those don't travel well either. Another caveat for this movie, which hopefully they pitched as more of a heisty fun movie rather than a comedy. There's a lot of money to be made around the world.
Yes. If you could send it to us, our address is... No, just kidding.
Well, my favorite thing this week, we know that Star Wars 9 is moving back to December 2019. I found that amusing because I wasn't quite sure why they gave up this December slot in the first place. But it's not easy when you have a movie as disliked as Mother was. But I did like the argument that Paramount Worldwide President of Marketing and Distribution, Megan Colligan, offered. She said, quote, "Everyone wants original filmmaking and everyone celebrates Netflix when they tell a story no one else wants to tell. This is our version. We don't want all movies to be safe. And it's okay if some people don't like it."
What I would say is, okay, let's review. You've been in business with Darren Aronofsky now for 2 movies, right? Noah being one of them and Mother being the other. Let's see how profitable either of those movies are.
Ouch. Are you saying no one should ever work with Darren Aronofsky again?
No, I'm just saying no, because I think he's actually a very talented filmmaker and he is taking risks. The problem that he has here is he's got 2 movies that may not, be...
No, they're money losers.
Yeah.
We're pretty confident they're not going to make money, at least initially at the box office. Certainly Noah was a flop. Mother, it's a less big risk. We'll have to see where it ends up. I assume it won't do well overseas, but you never know. And of course, there's a lot of money to be made with a horror flick on video and streaming and all that. So they probably won't lose their shirt. But again, why are they bitching about Netflix? That seems a weird thing to point to.
I don't know. I think because everybody is talking about Netflix all the time, every day. I think it was the Hollywood Reporter arrived over the weekend and I was reading. They asked 30 TV executives the same question. And one of the things that the one question that they asked all of them was, what comes up at every lunch? Okay, you know, every lunch meeting, what's the topic? What
the one bill?
Traffic was one, and Netflix was the other. Traffic and Netflix.
Well, I bet premium video on demand comes up. Yet another story. This one in Variety. It's from one of the heads of Lionsgate, and he says, "Video on demand, premium video on demand is just around the corner. Within 12 months, 90-day window will be shortened to 17 days." Movie theater owners will have 3 weekends to show their film, and then they'll come out on premium video on demand. And $50 is way too much. He says, Michael Burns, that is, that he took his son and a group of his son's friends to see Wonder Woman, and it costs more than $200.
Well,
that's a lot of kids, by the way.
Yeah.
How many kids and how much popcorn did you feed them? Because that would take a bit.
Yeah, first of all, I think, you know, full disclosure, I used to work with Michael Burns at the Hollywood Stock Exchange. And so there's that. But I will tell you that, yeah, I don't know where he was seeing, Wonder Woman other than Cinepolis.
Kids tickets to the movie, you know, yeah, unless you went to Cinepolis and paid $25 a head, you know, good God, man.
Yeah.
It's like, what would it be for a child's ticket to Wonder Woman? Your son is not a teenager.
I think his son is probably a teenager at this point.
Okay. So they're going to be paying how much a ticket?
Like probably $12.
So you got 10 kids and then popcorn. It doesn't take much, but a group of 10 kids is a lot of people to take to a movie, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Because even if you took like 5 kids, you know, even, and it's $15 a head. With popcorn.
And they all get popcorn and soda. Yeah.
So, you know, what I would say here is I was just on a conference call this past week. It was an analyst conference call. And it was it just sucked all of the time up. It was supposedly going to be one of the topics. It turned into the primary topic, okay? This is something everybody is looking at. And when you talk to Adam Aron, who is the CEO of AMC Theaters, he basically has said, we've talked to all of the distributors. Walt Disney is out. Disney Studios, they don't want to have any part of this whole PVOD thing. None of the studios have said through the end of the year, beginning of next year, they have any plans to do this because nothing has been worked out, and it's certainly not going to happen without AMC, the largest movie theater chain in the world. Okay.
And there's no reason for them to have any reason to say yes. No one has presented the slightest argument or convincing data to show them why they should do it.
Correct.
And
there's the rub.
And when studios do it, everyone says or try to do it or announce they're going to do it, the theater chains say, that's nice, good luck, we don't have to show your movie, and we're not going to.
And Regal has insinuated the same thing, Amy Miles of Regal, the CEO of Regal. And all of these analysts said, look, you know, these movies are made, they're big budget movies, and when they're made, the executives are taking into account that there will be a theatrical release. And they do their numbers, and they forecast their budgets based on the fact that they know how much they can make here or there, you know, if it's not a complete bomb, in a theatrical release. They're not planning for that movie to then be yanked out of movie theaters and placed on a premium VOD platform because there are no numbers for that. No matter how many times you slice and dice these numbers, the math doesn't work.
Well, it's something new, of course. It would be a new experiment. The only opportunity, again, would be something like Mother. If it falls 80% in weekend two and it's out of theaters by the third weekend, is there an argument to be said for, hey, why wait another 2 or 3 months or 10 weeks before we put it on premium video on demand? Why not just make it available now? Nobody's in the theater. We've just advertised it. They might just go. Does that just confuse people too much with windows and who the heck wants to see a flop for $40 or $30 or $50?
Well, you also then have what was referred to as the paperback effect. If you know, hey, Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run is going to be released on paperback someday. Okay, fine. I'll wait. Now, it was literally 1 year before that, you know, before you could get it in paperback.
Pretty typical.
Yes, they call that product versioning. It's typical across products, by the way. It's not just books. But if you happen to know, hey, you know what? We're going to, if we just don't go see the movie in movie theaters, it's going to be out on premium VOD in 3 weeks,
But that was an argument against VHS and an argument against DVD all those years ago. They said if people know they can see it in their home, they'll never bother going to the movie theater. If they can see it on cable, they'll never bother going to the movie theater. If they can get it on demand, they'll never bother going to the movie theater. That's an argument against every other way of showing movies that has ever been created.
Yeah, 3 weeks. 3 weeks is a pretty short time to wait. Okay. That was 6 months. VHS was 6 months minimum. Okay. And sometimes it was a year.
Yeah. But not anymore. Yeah.
Not anymore. But, you know, so you had this, you know,
but even then they were frightened that it would destroy the movie industry.
Right. This is basically you're releasing it on two different platforms at the same time, digitally or a compact disc. You know, that's basically the difference here.
That's pretty much what they do in the book world right now.
But right. Anyway. Correct. And what happened? What's going on with bookstores? How are they doing?
Sales are fine.
Bookstores?
Bookstores. Yeah. Sales are online. That's all. They've moved. Bookstores are chains are a different issue. People are buying books. It's a $20 billion industry. They're doing just fine.
No, I'm talking about the bookstores.
Well, that's a different issue than book sales because the big number one bookseller is not a store. It's Amazon. The biggest bookstore in the country is digital. Therefore, well, bookstores, you know, Amazon has like five stores. So yeah, there are not a lot of bookstores doing great, but book sales are online and they're doing just fine.
Are they coming to get you there, Michael? I hear
they are. Well, there's cops. I'm on the 14th floor and I can hear them.
Okay.
But they, yeah. All right. So anyway, but again, why not Mother?
Well, Mother is a great example.
On a case-by-case basis. Look,
we could probably spend an hour and a half talking about this. So here's what I will say. There will be no Big Bang where like, okay, it's this date and everything happens from that date on. That's not going to happen. However, right. To your point, Mother is a great example. Okay, you know what? Maybe by the fourth week, this movie's done. Okay, it might be done by the third week. So you know what? Maybe if theater chains say, look, we've got it out of most of our theaters. Okay, so it's not going to keep playing. You know, sure. You know what? You feel like doing that week five? Okay, fine. But here's the thing. A lot of the Carmike cinemas are a great example of theaters that really never played films off the break. And what that means is the film would open and they would get it 2 weeks later. So all of those theaters in towns that might not be numbered, you know, within the top 50 or 60 or 90 markets, they would get films maybe 2 weeks later.
Does that happen now? Because it used to be a print issue, I imagine.
It was a print issue, and it still happens. It definitely still happens. That said, that's still happening, and AMC just bought Carmike, and they're not going to turn their investment, they're not going to make it completely, you know, valueless by saying, sure, you know, play the film on PVOD in those markets and in those territories where, you know, we have theaters where the film is just opening.
Where there's sort of a second run cinema.
It's second run or like mid run, if you will.
Right. All right. So another reason why it's not going to happen anytime soon, if ever.
And you know what? It might happen in a hybrid form, which might be fine. And people are basically saying, look, you don't want to turn your theatrical movies into a second rate experience. You don't want to, you know, you had direct to DVD and everybody knew what that meant. Well, if you start doing premium VOD, maybe that's not going to be, maybe you'll be doing
the same thing. Well, again, they just grossed a record amount of box office in 2016. Why the heck would you want to mess with a winning formula? Why are you so desperate to mess up something that's working really well?
I agree.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. They keep talking about it. And investors are driving down the price of exhibitor stock because like, well, this is going to happen someday. Not if they have anything to say about it.
Well, and you know, I use books as an example, right? And that maybe that's a bad example because books are not a communal experience. You don't go and say, okay, everybody, let's get in a room and all read the book at the same time. So maybe that's a bad example. The same thing with television, right? People, okay, granted, yes, you have, you know, you can watch TV with a lot of people and it's almost virtually communal because we're all watching it on the same night, usually, not always, as we'll explain later. But sure enough, television is a little bit easier to disrupt in this way, as we found out through the Emmy Awards this year.
That's right. And so our final thought on this is until a major exhibitor chain speaks up and says, we're excited and ready and we're on board, ignore every single story that tells you video on demand is right around the corner.
Well, two things. One,
studio movies.
Yeah. Lachlan Murdoch at Fox was saying it last week, saying, oh, we have to, you know, it's going to close. It's inevitable, which I think is more his way of saying, you know,
please,
I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to keep saying this until somebody caves. I don't think, you know, I think everybody else on the distribution side and on the exhibition side is saying, Lachlan, can we sit down with some spreadsheets and show you some information?
Well, he's not
here?
The only one. Don't act like he's some newbie who doesn't know what he's talking about.
No, Kevin Suzuhara says the same thing. over at Warner Brothers.
This is, again, those are the studios. Until an exhibitor speaks up and says they're on board, ignore every single story because it's not true.
What I will say, speaking of studios again, is Michael Burns works for Lionsgate, which just happens to own a premium VOD or a, you know, day and date VOD company. So it's called Lionsgate Premiere. So there you go.
All right, let's move on to the Emmys. We said people gather together to watch television. It can happen. It's not happening for the Emmys, though. The ratings look like they could be another all-time low. I don't think there's going to be a lot of time shifting, but that might help. They're thinking maybe 11 million people watch the Emmys. Why? Perhaps it's because most of the people hadn't seen most of the shows that were up for top awards. How many people subscribe to Hulu, and how many of them watched The Handmaid's Tale? It got a lot of press, but it's not getting huge ratings in terms of the tens of millions of people who watched Games of Thrones.
Yeah, you know what? When, by the way, Game of Thrones not eligible. But what I will say is I noticed that too yesterday. I went, wow, look at all of these shows that I need to catch up on. This is us. I always made a joke. I said, I'm not watching it. You know, I'm not going to cry. Because everybody who watches that show tells me, oh, you got to bring your box of handkerchiefs.
Well, that is the hit, though. That is a Walking Dead, Game of Thrones type hit. That is a monster hit. So that's not something like The Handmaid's Tale or The Night of. I mean, that's a real blockbuster.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, The Night of was one of those shows I always wanted to watch, and I just never found the time. There's just too much to watch, first of all. And so maybe instead of watching the Emmys and people like basically pat themselves on the back, everybody was off watching some of the good TV.
Well, let's hope so, because there is a lot of good TV to check out. What did you think of the show itself?
I thought, you know, it was the same as all of these types of shows are. I thought I don't know, what can I possibly say that hasn't been said about these shows already?
Well, they did a pretty good job of spreading around the awards. There are repeat winners, of course, like Veep, but there was also a lot of new blood in there. The new records were set in terms of color, people of color, representation. This person won best directing in a comedy. That person won best, first black woman to win for writing a drama, and so on and so forth. That was cool to see. The people on air were actually representative of America, though, as a number of them pointed out afterwards, that doesn't change the fact that TV overall has a lot of work to do.
Yeah, you know, my daughter came in as I began to watch the Emmys, time shifted, by the way. And she went, oh, is this the Emmys? And I said, yes. She said, oh, I wanted to watch this. And I thought, I kind of looked at her sideways like, what? You're like, how do you even know what the Emmys are? And I actually asked, I said, how do you know what the Emmys are? And she said, it's for music, right? And I went, no, that's the Grammys. So she's sitting down and watching, the Emmys with me, and then Alec Baldwin wins, right? And she's like, oh, I love this guy. Do the Donald Trump. Did you do the Donald Trump already? Did I miss that? And then Kate McKinnon wins, right, for Saturday Night Live. And she says, oh, I know her. She's Donald Trump's helper. And then Donald Glover wins, and she's like, wow, he's like rocking that suit. It's so purple.
Well, she had a good time.
I had more fun watching this with my youngest daughter than I did. As soon as she went to bed, I was like, oh, well, this is boring now.
Well, I did think Donald Glover looked very dapper, and I loved his reference to thanking the great algorithm in the sky. I thought that was very funny. That was certainly a positive on the show. Jermaine Fowler doing the voiceover work, I thought was a disaster. And I did enjoy Oprah holding court a la Jack Nicholson at the Oscars. She was in the front row. Everybody referenced her. It felt just like Jack at the Academy Awards.
It did in the 1980s and early 90s, where like he was just always there with his sunglasses on and, you know, always like, thank you very much. You know, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. And Rachel Bloom, someday soon, our favorite woman from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, is going to be hosting the Tonys or the Emmys or something, because she's born to do it.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I mean, I think she's wonderful. I mean.
Oh, yeah.
And she basically did that whole accountants thing and took, granted, she stole the show from the accountants, which, frankly, the accountants are probably happy about.
No, that's just fine. And she sang live.
Yes. Unlike Stephen Colbert. As a host, I would not expect him to sing live. I barely expect him to sing at all. He may not have been singing. That may have been a stunt voice.
Mm-hmm. No, I imagine he was singing. It sounded, you know, I think that was him. He just had a pre-recorded track, because it's hard to sing and dance at the same time.
Right. Just ask Britney Spears.
Yeah. So, you know, again, this is television. You can argue about what categories things won in, stuff won that shouldn't have, stuff didn't win that should have, and so on and so forth. But you did get a good list, especially if you looked at the nominees of some shows to catch up on. Have you watched Masters of None? Have you watched Fargo? Have you watched Black Mirror? You know, check it out.
Well, here's my question, because here's the issue that I have. Okay, Handmaid's Tale. Now, I'm going to admit I haven't seen it because I wanted to read the book first, okay? And you know I'm a slow reader, Michael, okay? Mm-hmm. So
you keep moving your lips.
Right, exactly. Now, also, that book came out in 1985. I should have read it by now. But that said, I also don't have Hulu, okay? So there's that. So here's the question. I thought The Handmaid's Tale, the series, was just a mini series, that it was just going to be an adaptation of the book on Hulu, and then that was it. Is that correct?
No. They created a world, and they have planned for multiple seasons. They're living in that world.
So it was always designed
as a TV series. It was not intended to have a beginning, middle, and end, and be done with. So the book is open ended. The TV show is open ended.
Okay, so if I read the book, if I watch the TV series, will it ruin the book?
I don't believe so. Oh no! I mean, no. I don't. No. It won't. I mean, you'll certainly see things happen in the book, but no, it's not like that.
So they're different? The stories are different? Or is the first season...
No, it's just the book does not end with, you know, Katniss Evergreen overthrowing the government and restoring liberty. It's a dystopian novel. It's depressing. It is not a, we've defeated the bad guys. So, yeah, no, it's open-ended.
Okay. And then apparently I've got to watch this. I mean, literally, except for, you know, last week tonight and Saturday Night Live, I didn't see any of these things.
Well, there you go. You got a lot of catching up to do.
Well, I did see Masters of None, which is a really good show.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot I want to see. I have not watched Atlanta yet, for example. And that was the show that Donald Glover set some records for by winning as a director in a comedy and won as a writer alongside his queer black woman of color, co-writer who gave a shout out to her girlfriend. It must make middle America's head explode.
Yeah, you're talking about Masters of None, Aziz Ansari.
Oh, see, I'm racist. You're right.
Yeah. So, yes. And you could tell Aziz wanted to say something. I say that like I know him. Aziz, my friend Aziz. No, but she...
I thought it was very grateful of him to let her have the moment in the spotlight.
Yes.
He didn't look like he was trying to butt in. When at the end he did, he wanted to say something, but, you know, he didn't push his way to the fore or anything like that.
Yeah, and speaking of which, when Sterling K. Brown won for Best Actor in a Drama for This Is Us, right, he was summarily, and he did kind
Not
of...
Not summarily.
Well, okay, yeah, he was kind of... taking a long time. But you know who else took a long time? Nicole Kidman. But there's a difference. She's a movie star, and they just let her drone on. And
he's a previous Emmy winner.
And he's a previous Emmy winner. And I thought, you know what? You could tell he was moving toward wrapping it up. You probably could have let him go another 15 seconds. Okay.
Yeah, I thought they made a mistake. It's always tricky, but I don't think that they treated him... people say, he's like, you're playing the loud music on me. You didn't do that before. I felt like he'd been given a fair amount of time, but people got stopwatches out and they're tracking. It's like, oh, Nicole Kidman got an extra 45 seconds. And in fact, they pulled the camera back and were way up in the air and cut his mic, but they were still there doing nothing. So they wasted that time anyway. I thought they should have let him finish. He was giving a good speech. They don't seem to take into account the speech. If a person starts to natter on like Laura Dern, play them off. They're just rambling. If they're actually giving a coherent, well thought out, entertaining speech, for the love of God, let them finish.
Yeah, I mean, I thought when Lorne Michaels won for Saturday Night Live, I could tell his speech was going to be a little bit slow, but I also knew it was going to be short. I mean, the way he kind of like put that whole thing, I thought when we won in 1976, I never thought we could have another season that wouldn't, you know, be as crazy, as unbelievable, and I was wrong. And you just knew that was going to be it. He was going to be gone. So you didn't have to play him off. With Sterling K. Brown, I did wonder, okay, where does this end? Because this could go on for a while. But I also thought as he was about, it seemed like he was turning to the end. They could have, waited just a beat. What I will say is I know that there's somebody at the end of the show, because that came at the very end of the show, where they're like, whoa, we are like about to run over here, and they get fined for that, so they actually have to speed things along. Nicole Kidman came at the end too, so they could have sped her along as well.
All right, and dear God, Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon complaining that they can't find good roles. imagine how the actors who aren't famous movie stars feel.
Exactly.
They're both Oscar-winning movie stars, and they're saying, we can't find good roles. I'm like, really? Wow. They should read more books like Reese does.
Oh, that's right, because, of course, Big Little Lies. Did I just say that right? Big Little Lies?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, that's based
on
the book.
I don't know.
Little Big Lies.
Little
Thank
Big
you. Lies. Little Big Lies. You see, I can't watch the shows because I can't even... Big Little Lies. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, well, that's based on a book. And you know what? I don't know whether you picked it on BookFilter as one of the top books of the week, month, or year when it was published, but that's kind of what you do, actually, over at BookFilter.com, a book lover's best friend. You pick books for people to read, good books for people to read, and every week you show up here with a book or two that Hollywood or the entertainment world should be paying attention to, possibly for an adaptation. What have you got for us this week?
Well, you know, did we mention at the top of the show that you could win an Oscar if you option this book?
Yes, you did. You did.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, just option a book about a park bench. It's called Park Bench by the French comic book writer Christophe Chabutet. I'm not sure how to say his name. His latest book focuses on a park bench and observes life simply by observing the bench. People come and go. They grow up. They grow old. They die. The seasons come. Lovers, friends, people carving their names into the bench, and so on and so forth. It's simple. It's elegant. And it would make a great animated short. And his previous book alone is also ripe for the picking. And I don't think anyone's picked up on him yet. But he's an intriguing talent. And if you're looking for a property to turn into a great short, this is a good one.
A great short. So this wouldn't be a, you know, I don't see, do you follow the characters around or?
No. You follow the bench. You're just watching the bench. The world comes to the bench.
Okay.
So it's just by observing. And there was another book a year or two ago that took place simply looking out the window of one room of a house and how, this little space from prehistoric times up to the present. You just focus on that one space and see how the world changes around you. It would just make a really good animated short.
And it's a graphic novel. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a comic book. We're getting back to calling them comic books. It's okay now.
All right.
Comic book, graphic novel, manga, blah, blah. It's like they're all comic books. It's all right. There's dignity to be had in the phrase comic book. And there's dignity to be had in publishing your memoir. Hillary Clinton came out with a memoir. And as sometimes happens with famous people, everybody weighs in without even reading the book. They're like, I hate her.
Yes.
They give it 1 star. I wouldn't buy this book. And happily, Amazon is being a little more proactive. When a lot of people weigh in on a title right away, they say, all right, these people have not read the book. They're not verified purchases. And if it's something controversial or somebody, a polarizing public figure, they say, okay. And they remove all the reviews from people who didn't actually purchase the book at Amazon. So there were about 1,500 reviews of the book. They pulled a lot of them out, and there were about 600 remaining. So, you know, I think that's a smart thing. It's what they should do. They can't monitor every book every day. But when something big like that, you know, causes a spark and that sort of thing, they can and should act.
Well, now, do you think you have to read this book? Because I feel like with all the interviews and all of the excerpts that have been published, it's almost like you've read the book already.
Well, I'm not a big fan of, you know, the instant memoir. I haven't read the book by a reporter covering the election campaign. It's nice for nuggets of information and some inside scoop. I feel like you need a little perspective in a few years before you can write something really substantial and worthwhile. Those books will almost certainly draw upon stuff mentioned in Hillary Clinton's book. Though I have heard the chapter on where she thinks the Democratic Party should go forward is really good and compelling and really good stuff. So I might want to check that out.
Well, I'll tell you, if they actually pick up on it, that could be interesting. The Democrats, that is, the Democratic Party. It could be interesting if they actually kind of use that as a blueprint.
Right. Well, they've been winning off elections. They've picked up a number of Republican seats. They haven't lost a single seat yet. So the polling and the trending is looking good around the country for the Democrats. And if they have a big win in 2018, or it's unlikely, but take back the Senate, that would be a really big deal.
Wait, well, if that's a big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. We're going to race through these because we have to talk to Ann Thompson. Our first story, new talk show hosts get reviewed after just 1 day on the job. We all know that. Sometimes the reviews are pretty good. John Oliver was seen as an immediate win for HBO, and his contract has been extended for 3 years. But other times, it's a long haul to success. Look at Trevor Noah. Comedy Central has re-upped his contract for another 5 years. With Noah on board the channel's signature series through 2022, he's guaranteed more money, primetime specials, and more. Why? They're up 14% in total viewers this season over there at The Daily Show compared to last, with the show ranking third in key demos by beating out Jimmy Kimmel, Seth Meyers, and James Corden. Noah has also posted monthly and quarterly gains. His audience is the wealthiest and educated in late night. Online, he's doing even better, by the way, generating more than 2.2 billion views since taking over and up 50% year to year. Big deal or big whoop?
Two guys get a contract extension. Big whoop, I guess. But it's interesting to see the numbers that they quote. Very excited by the key demos. They're very excited by his digital presence. That is where a lot of money is being made in late night.
That is correct, yes. And I think that the big deal here is that the handoff from Jon Stewart after 17 years to Trevor Noah didn't get fumbled, because a lot of people thought, you're handing this show to kind of he's virtually unknown.
He is unknown.
Yeah, how could you do this? Well, it worked, and The Daily Show is still alive and ticking. Apple has a new phone and a new watch. And yes, a new stab at Apple TV. The latter includes 4K movies they want to offer for the same price as regular old high def, and their price point of choice is $20. That's Apple's price point. Every studio is on board except Disney, who sells 4K movies at Walmart for $25. The streaming device is also HDR friendly, whatever that means these days. Does Apple know something about price points? When ebooks were $10 across the board, it established the format as the most popular in the country, bigger than hardcover and paperback. Remember the lawsuits? That should tell you whether they know something about pricing.
That had nothing to do, yeah. That didn't mean the price point was wrong.
Right. Will they convert people to 4K as well? That's my question. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm handing it over to you.
Well, here's the thing. Congratulations, you're doing something that everybody did 3 years ago with 4K. So will they convert people to 4K? It's not that they're converting people to 4K, it's that the industry went 4K, so they kind of had to. More and more content is coming out in 4K. All the TVs are 4K, so they're basically just making a box that can feed most television sets that are being sold these days.
So they're just playing catch-up.
Right. What I would say is be careful about HDR. There is no standard for that. And as I learned with the television set that I purchased in 2002, I got an HD ready television set. It had component HD, meaning it had a cable that was not standardized yet. Of course, 3 years later, or not even like a year or two later, HDMI became the standard, and I couldn't watch half the stuff. Like none of the DVD players or Blu-ray players worked with my TV. HDR has no standard right now. They're working on it, but there is no standard. So whatever Apple has in its box as a standard or as HDR friendly may not exist a couple of years from now. Heads up. Speaking of heads up, HBO is determined to deliver a spinoff of their fantasy smash hit Game of Thrones. But writer George R.R. Martin isn't just sitting around waiting for that to happen. He's already got another series greenlit at the Sci-Fi Channel, or as Karen Woodward liked to say, SIFI. It's called Night Flyers and is based on a 1980 novella and a 1987 film made from that novella. The story involves Earth's impending doom and a crew sent on the planet's most advanced craft to rendezvous with an alien craft headed our way. Happens every day. Perhaps they'll save us. Or perhaps things will get more complicated. Whatever happens to the crew and the show, somewhere fans of Martin's Game of Thrones novels are crying themselves softly to sleep at night. He's never finishing that. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I don't think he's got day-to-day show running status on the show. It's just happening, and I'm sure he'll consult and all that and have a producing credit. And he's got a credit on another show written by another writer. So, you know, he's a busy man. His name is helping sell shows and get them on the air. But I don't think it's really going to delay the writing of his books.
Now, forget about Apple's HD price point of $20. Maybe 10 is the magic number. MoviePass, the all-you-can-eat offer for film buffs, announced a new, simpler price point of $10 a month. You might recall this is the, you know, you become a subscriber and you can get to go see all the movies you want in movie theaters. They also cleared away the confusion, by the way, and allowed subscribers to go see one movie each calendar day. Now you can go to a movie on Friday night and another on Saturday afternoon. MoviePass had a measly 20,000 subscribers and hoped this relaunch would get them several hundred thousand by the end of the year on their way to going public. Well, it worked. Some 400,000 people have now signed up for the service in the first 4 weeks, and MoviePass has a backlog of orders to fulfill as people wait for their membership cards. Their new goal? A total of more than 2 million subscribers after 12 months. Along the way, however, they'll be losing money on virtually every ticket purchased by every subscriber. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, right? You know, we're losing more money today than we were yesterday. Good business plan.
It'll be a big deal when you get the shrinkage numbers, meaning people who join the gym and then don't go, and you can figure out how much all of that data you can sell from all of those 2 million customers. You have 2 million customers.
Well, that's where they pretend they're going to make their money, and I don't think the numbers add up.
Yeah, I mean, there's the rub.
Not when they're buying full ticket prices.
Correct. Well, when you have 2 million customers, you might be able to start negotiating. We'll see. The conservative publishing imprint, how do you pronounce this? Is it Regnery?
I'm not sure.
Well, it's dumping the New York Times. No, they're not refusing to have their books listed on the most famous bestseller list in America, but they will stop using the New York Times as any sort of metric in their author contracts. Regnery says the formula used by the Times to determine its bestseller is biased against conservative titles, whether knowingly or unknowingly. The final straw came for Regnery when its best-selling author, Dinesh D'Souza, had a new book out. The convicted felon was plugging his book, The Big Lie.
Which he would know something about.
Right. It hit number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. But according to actual book sales via Nielsen, that week his book was number 1 out of all nonfiction titles. It's not a case of the New York Times selectively choosing to ignore an author, but more about the secret methodology they use to create their charts. So in the future, Regnery will switch from using the New York Times to Publishers Weekly when determining bonuses for authors and employees, etc. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's the right move to make. The Times is not based on actual sales. Publishers Weekly's chart is better and more accurate, just like BookScan is, and just like a Billboard is back in the day when they just based the album charts on album sales. I want to know actual sales. That's what Publishers Weekly is using, and therefore they were right to switch. The Times chart is not a great metric for what people are actually buying. Just like the pop charts got overthrown when suddenly people said, oh my God, people are buying rap music and country. They couldn't believe it. The same thing can happen if you look at the Publishers Weekly chart. This is what people are actually buying, and that's the metric they should use.
TV network heads held forth with the press recently, and all of them made news of some sort or another. NBC's Bob Greenblatt agrees with Michael, actually, that overnight ratings are a dinosaur. Indeed, he caught our ear with this little fact, a fact that indicates a permanent sea change in how people consume TV. According to Greenblatt, 52% of the people watching NBC primetime shows do so after a show airs. Yes, most of the people choose to watch NBC's lineup when and where they want. That number will only grow, and the money is following the eyeballs, of course. Fully 1/3 of the revenue for NBC's hit drama, This Is Us, comes from digital. That's a shocking fact. I kind of wonder whether that's happening in London or the UK with the BBC and in France and Germany and elsewhere. Big deal or big whoop?
If someone knows, they should contact us if they know what's happening digitally for TV providers in the rest of the world. It's a very big deal. The only thing, and it's a permanent change. It's just going to get bigger and bigger. More and more people are going to continue to time shift. But I would point out that info about digital revenue, they're just talking about the first run, first showing of the TV show. It's certainly not 1/3 of the revenue, including, syndication, sales worldwide, because that's a much bigger number. So I'm thinking that's just basically whatever they made on the first airing of the show, 1/3 of it comes from digital.
Now, it really is the end of an era. Just a week after we learned Graydon Carter will be stepping down from Vanity Fair, word comes that Jan Wenner is putting his magazine Rolling Stone up for sale. His son Gus runs alongside Jan, and they both insist they'd like to stay on, but of course, that will be up to the new owners. Recently, they sold Us Weekly and Men's Journal. That was followed by a sale of 49% of Rolling Stone to a music tech company in Singapore. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Absolutely. It's a valuable property, at least once upon a time. I think they're still doing pretty well digitally. And the new owners are going to keep them on. How much are you paying yourself in salary? Good heavens.
Yeah. I have to say, they do great journalism, some not just music journalism, but journalism. Not to discount music journalism, but I mean, political journalism. They do some really good stuff.
Well, that's where they took a hit, of course, because they had a devastatingly bad article on campus rape The New York Times, by the way, has a kerfuffle over a review they just did about a book on campus rape. They had to put a sort of an ugly correction into their newspaper today. And Rolling Stone had a disaster in that area, and that has given them a black eye. But by and large, 98% of the stuff they do on politics and global warming is, in fact, very well reported and very solid.
Yes. So, I mean, I will say I get the magazine. It becomes thinner and thinner with every issue.
Yes, but I buy it for those investigative articles and for that political commentary. And I like being able to access it all online. And I hope anyone who buys it does not try and dumb it down.
I agree. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as promised, we have one of our special guests, Ann Thompson, the editor-at-large of IndieWire. She is back from pretty much an around-the-world journey, or at least around North America, where she was. You were at Telluride, correct, Ann?
Yep.
And then at Toronto.
Yep.
And now back in Los Angeles. Now, I guess Telluride and Toronto, they show a lot of the same films.
Well, some you could include Venice in that. And so some of them, like Mother and Three Billboards, debuted in Venice, Shape of Water. Then some Shape of Water went to Telluride, Mother and Three Billboards went to Toronto. You know, they divvied it up between the three.
Some people suggested that Toronto felt more like an also-ran this year. I think that was Variety that said that.
I really disagree with that, because what happens is that there's a momentum that comes out of the other festivals, and then you have a much bigger group of people in Toronto, a much wider swath of media from all over the place. And they decide, if you like, they take everything they've learned. Telluride is definitely the Oscar bellwether, but it needs to, because they're curating, they're picking, they're cherry picking the best stuff. But you need Toronto to amplify and push and sort of filter everything. And so that you know where you stand. Like Mother played really well in Venice, and then it played very well in Toronto, but it became clear that people were confused by it. And Aronofsky started talking about it more, and then it opened and belly flopped.
Pretty much, completely. Yeah.
So, you know, you need all the things to come together to figure it out. It's a very wide field. It's a very disparate field. Nobody would have predicted that Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, for example, would be the winner of no one would predict that it would win the audience prize in Toronto, which is sometimes considered such a predictor of best picture.
And remember, American Beauty, for instance, won that prize. And what we're talking about here, for those who don't know, is the Telluride Film Festival held in Colorado over Labor Day, the first weekend of September here in the U.S. And then right afterwards, Toronto, which had 255 titles this year, which is down by, it's 20% smaller than last year.
No one would ever be able to tell the difference, which is one of the reasons why they should have, why it was a good idea.
Well, and usually you watch a film debut in one festival and it gets good buzz and it builds and builds and builds. This year, if you watch Downsizing, directed by Alexander Payne and starring Matt Damon, it looked more like a penny stock. It was up, it was down, it was up again.
Part of what's going on, if I may be so bold, is that you do have a lot of people covering these things who have a rooting interest in Oscar advertising, not to put too fine a point on it. And that includes IndieWire, by the way. But I think it's safe to say that Downsizing is not going to be one of the top Oscar contenders, because it's sort of like Mother in a way. It has too many weird things going on where people don't understand it, or they don't like this or they like that. I mean, it's divisive. There's no sense of consensus about that movie being an utterly wonderful, fabulous success. And Alexander Payne has set the bar so high for so long. And this movie is so ambitious and in just all the right ways, which, by the way, I defend Mother too, for the same reasons. We want filmmakers to be able to do this. It's just that when it comes to the Oscars, at least, if not, you know, the box office, you kind of need people to know what they're looking at and how to understand it. And I think that, that he doesn't quite pull it together in the case of Downsizing.
And this
That's
is right.
why you're getting all those reactions.
Okay. Well, what are some of the movies that you did like at both of these festivals?
Well, I think Shape of Water came out 100% ahead, Guillermo del Toro's fantasy. It's a romance. I think Sally Hawkins is at the head of the Best Actress list, along with Frances McDormand, who did very well with Three Billboards. And that's those are two Fox Searchlight movies. So you actually have a kind of a resurgence because they did well with Battle of the Sexes, too. That played very well everywhere it went. And Emma Thompson is very strong as Billie Jean King, the heroic tennis player who challenged and defeated Bobby Riggs.
And that's
Emma Stone.
Emma Stone, yeah.
What did I say?
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson's in something else. She's in a movie called The Children Act, and she did very well, too, although I don't think that will come out this year. I think it'll come out later. It got picked up by A24 and DirecTV. It's a Richard Eyre movie.
Well, before we talk about acquisitions, The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro, which you always know he's going to do something interesting.
Do you?
I think this
is his first good movie since Pan's Labyrinth. I'm excited to see it, but
it's
he hasn't been making very...
It may be his best movie ever, because it's English language, and he takes everything and puts it all into one very coherent and whole package.
Do we want to know what it's about going in, or do we just want to go in and just know that something as interesting is going to happen?
You just know he creates a special world. It's a fantasy world. It's got influences from old movies. It has characters you've never seen before. It has outsiders who fall in love. It has villain played by Michael Shannon. You shall see it all.
And what about this movie, Lady Bird? Greta Gerwig's, I guess it's a Generation X, is it a coming-of-age drama, or I guess it is a drama?
It has a lot of comedic elements in it. I think Greta Gerwig finally comes into her own in a way that some of us saw coming. I mean, if you looked at Frances Ha, which she co-wrote and starred in with her partner Noah Baumbach directing, or if you looked at Mistress America, which she also co-wrote with him, this woman is, if you just look at the kind of work she did in Mumblecore with Joe Swanberg or the improvisation she was capable of, she always had a very strong personality. So in this case, it's very semi-autobiographical. It's Saoirse Ronan playing Greta Gerwig, if you like, a version of her, and Laurie Metcalf as her mother. It's sort of like Boyhood in the sense that if you... you're capable of really identifying with it and understanding it and talking about it afterwards. It's a very universal story, and I think it will go far at the Oscars all the way around. Major directing talent.
And what does the year look like for the industry as far as going to festivals and picking up movies? We've seen cycles before where some years everybody wants to acquire movies, and then other years people realize they want to be there at the start. They want to make movies happen. They want to option screenplays, or they want to be there at the beginning and not wait till it's actually made. This year,
there
some people
some
said...
There were some sales. Itania was the big sale with Margot Robbie, and you also had Children Act selling, and you had Paul Schrader's first Reformed selling to A24 also, which is a wonderful home for that wonderful movie with Ethan Hawke, a return to form for him. But the buyers weren't thrilled because there really was a small list of contending titles to purchase that were ever going to be commercial, because most of the studios, as you say, have picked up things ahead of time.
Yeah, it did seem like I think you called it in your piece a cherry picking. But of course, as you mentioned, also there's some risk to that. You could pick up a film and then it didn't play that well at the festival. Hey, as we've learned, you could play really well at a festival, Mother, and then not do well in the theater, Mother.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
So
or Patty Cakes or The Birth of a Nation.
Correct. Now, I guess one of the things that I thought was very interesting coming out of Toronto was Gary Oldman as Sir Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour. And everybody's saying, look, he's going to be a tough act to beat for best actor. And I just thought, wow, what is it with Winston Churchill between Dunkirk and The Crown and now Darkest Hour? Winston Churchill is having a huge revival.
Well, one of the things that the screenwriter Anthony McCartan, who wrote Theory of Everything and Darkest Hour, and said to me that when he was choosing this project, a friend of his said, well, take that one, do that one, because right now we need leaders. And that's basically what Lithgow said when he won for Winston Churchill at the Emmys Sunday night. So we need Winston Churchill. It's so moving to see how alone he was, how strong he was, how much he galvanized the country and his own the opposition, everybody who was fighting against him, even brought the king around, King George, who didn't really like him. You know, it's a very dramatic story of leadership, basically, and it works. It works very well. Gary Oldman is amazing in this movie.
And just John Lithgow won for The Crown, an Emmy for The Crown, for playing Winston Churchill in The Crown. Now, I guess before we move on to one last topic on maybe Netflix, let me ask you about this Three Billboards. What is this movie? It did seem to come out of nowhere in terms of winning the audience prize for those of us watching from afar.
I agree. It was a complete surprise, and I've been actually trying to account for it. And I've decided that A, there was probably a very strong field competing for that. You know, I bet the numbers are really close. And B, there, I would say that Canadians lean into Brits and Irish people. You know, in other words, Martin McDonagh, there's something about this that they related to, but it's also angry. It's a very angry movie. It's a movie about what's wrong with the world and what's wrong with racism and what's wrong with people who don't fight to protect young women from rapists and murderers. I'm not saying that's anything funny. The movie has this brilliant combination of incredible writing, incredible acting. Sam Rockwell and Woody Harrelson and Frances McDormand are all amazingly good, and it will all be in the running for Oscar nominations. And Martin McDonagh will be for writing. I'm surprised that that's what won the audience prize, really, but it must have been close.
Well, now, one player up there, actually, there are two players, maybe more. You have Amazon and you have Netflix. However, one releases movies in movie theaters, that's Amazon, and another, which picks up movies and then they release them in a few theaters, but really they're picking them up to go onto their streaming service. First They Killed My Mother, for instance, is the Angelina Jolie film. It's not a documentary, it's a
fictional film, and it's Cambodia's pick for their foreign language entry.
Right. And she's a Cambodian citizen, and she has Rithi Pan helping her with it. And it's actually, I really recommend this movie. It is beautifully made, and it shows you how good something can be when it's pure, when it's unadulterated, when it's, she's just telling this little girl's story from her point of view. And in a weird way, it softens the story because the little girl is looking away, or the little girl is looking at insects, or she's looking at nature, whatever. It's a strong, strong movie that doesn't have to glossy itself up to become something that would be palatable in theaters or for studio heads. It doesn't have any, you know, Chinese star, you know, playing the mother, or, you know, selling to China or anything. It's a $24 million movie, biggest movie ever made in Cambodia. And it's very good. I highly recommend it. It's on Netflix now.
Now, can it actually succeed during the award season without being, well, I guess we're going to find out, right?
It'll be for foreign language. That's a different bar.
Okay.
It doesn't have to go for Best Picture and all that other stuff. This is it's a Cambodian language movie, and therefore it will compete in that arena with the Foreign Language Committee and the people that, and in competing with movies like The Square and Thelma and In the Fade and A Fantastic Woman. These are all movies that played very well at all these festivals. It will be up against them.
But will Oscar voters resist it because it's not playing in movie theaters?
I don't think so. It doesn't matter for foreign language or documentaries. It does matter for a movie like Mudbound. That's where you have a situation where it's going after Best Picture, it's going after Best actress and best actor and all this stuff, that's a different ball of wax. It's also, how do you convince people to see Mudbound and watch Mudbound if it's not in theaters for more than a week? I think that becomes an issue.
And Mudbound was at Sundance, and then it was at, I believe, Toronto?
Yeah.
And it'll be a New York Film Festival.
And this is a film, what is this film, what is Mudbound about?
So Dee Rees, who did that Queen Latifah, Bessie Smith movie on HBO, and she also directed Pariah. She's a fierce and strong director, and she has this post-World War II parallel families, one white, one African-American, two guys who both come back from the war and bond with each other, one white, one African-American, played by Garrett Hudland and Jason Mitchell, Carrie Mulligan, Jason Clark, and supporting actress Mary Blige. You know, one of those things where you just don't recognize her, and she's great. So it's a beautiful, epic, sweeping, gorgeous, incredibly ambitious movie. And the question is, who's going to watch it? You know, it comes down to that. How do you get that kind of momentum that was created? They're using the festivals, obviously, but how do the Academy voters know that they have to see this movie? That's the question.
And so was Netflix and Amazon, were they players up there this year in Toronto and Telluride, or were they, you know?
Well, there's Wonderstruck, which is the Todd Haynes movie, which was in Telluride and will be in New York. So they're going to try to bring that back from its initial reaction in Cannes.
Okay.
So Julianne Moore, I think, would be a strong supporting actress contender for Wonderstruck. They have Amazon has opening night, Last Flag Flying, the Richard Linklater, and then they have closing night with Wonder Wheel, the Amazon Woody Allen movie, and so there's plenty of stuff going on for Amazon out of New York mostly, and then Netflix has a lot of docs too, many docs.
They always
do. Some of them in Toronto, some of them in New York.
Well, it's obviously a good year for women. And overall, with the Oscar race, do you feel like there's a lot of really strong contenders, or are you just waiting for the big ones to show up?
Well, this is a situation where we don't have one obvious leader. I mean, I think you see three. You see Shape of Water, Lady Bird, and maybe Darkest Hour kind of dominating the conversation. But it isn't obvious now. Dunkirk could still be the leader. And Dunkirk showed up in Toronto and they did a big screening and Christopher Nolan spoke, and you know, they tried to drum the you know, and Dunkirk versus Darkest Hour, sort of, and they're companion pieces. They're very, they both deal with Dunkirk. They both have the Winston Churchill speech at the end. So you have a lot of, World War II movies competing too. I think they both will be in the running.
Cool. I hope Dunkirk certainly will be. My question was more about the quality of films on tap this year. Are you feeling like it's a really good year as opposed to the horse race for Oscar? Do you feel like there are a lot of good movies to choose from?
Yes. There's many, many, many movies came out of these festivals with momentum and want to see. Molly's Game played very well in Toronto. I mean, I don't know how far it'll go Oscar-wise, but I think it'll be a commercial movie. I think Jessica Chastain is a major movie star and pulls people in to see her. And Aaron Sorkin has directed a movie that people are going to, written and directed. It's his debut. So that's a true story. That'll be a good one. I think, for example, Battle of the Sexes is going to be very commercial. So there's plenty going on, no question about it.
Well, we certainly look forward to keeping in touch with you as we enter Oscar season, and certainly after the Oscars, talking to you about what happened. I imagine it's not going to be as much of a surprise ending as it was last year.
No, we shall find out. And there's a lot of movies coming at the end of the year and out of New York that, you know, we haven't seen yet. So the story is still being written. It isn't clear now.
Well, Ann Thompson, Editor-at-Large of IndieWire, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Well, it was good, Van, to join us. Always fun to catch up on the festivals, especially when I am not able to make the circuit.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've been to Telluride a couple of times, and I've wanted to go back to Toronto. I just, you know, there's only so much time in the year and only so many trips you can take. I mean, I'm going to Brazil next week, and I knew that, so I couldn't go this year.
If money were no object, I would absolutely go to Cannes and Toronto and New York. That would cover you pretty much for the year. Stuff plays at Venice and Telluride and elsewhere, but it's going to pop up at one of those three for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I looked at all of the films that were playing in Toronto, I realized that at least half of the good movies from Cannes were there.
Of course, yeah.
It is kind of known as the Festival of Festivals.
Well, but they show a ton of them. I feel like New York is sort of that curated idea where they say, we're going to pull the best movies that we can from other festivals. We don't mind that they've played somewhere else first. We'll have our exclusives, but I feel like it's a really good catch-up festival. But Toronto certainly is as well because they show so many of them.
Yes, and I appreciate Anne coming to talk to us not only about that, but what she thinks is, you know, how the award season is shaping up.
That's right. Some sad news from the set, of course. We're in the obituary section. And Narcos is a TV show. Is that on Netflix?
It is a Netflix show, yes.
Yes. And sadly, a location manager was shot and killed in Mexico. They're moving the location of this season apparently to Mexico. And location scout Carlos Munoz Portal died while looking for sites for season 4. So that's dreadful, sad news. We don't know all the information yet. He's experienced, of course, in Mexico and has scouted for a lot of other films. Very sad news. You hate to hear anybody dying while trying to make a movie. This sounds like something completely separate from safety on set, obviously, because he was just looking for sets, locations to shoot on, but sad, dreadful news.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because a while back I was trying to rack my brain and remember, is Martin Landau alive? And then like a week later, he passed away. I went, well, not anymore. Just last week, I was thinking of Harry Dean Stanton. And I thought to myself, did I read that he died? Is he still alive? Is he still alive?
Well, he's 90. He was 91 years old. So I guess it's not unusual to not be sure.
And then literally last week, he dies.
Do me a favor. Don't ask yourself whether I'm alive.
I don't mean to laugh about it. But look, I loved Harry Dean Stanton to the point that one New Year's Eve in the 1990s, I went and saw him perform in some dive bar. He was singing with some band, and it was like a lot of fun. I mean, you could have just walked up and pushed him over. He was like right there in front of you. There was like maybe 200 people in the room.
Well, he followed his own drum, didn't he?
Yeah, he was great. He was a character actor, and if you think you haven't heard of him, you have, because he was in a ton of stuff. Cool Hand Luke, in fact, was one of his films. He was in Alien. He was in The Rose. He was in Escape from New York. I mean, he was a character actor.
And as Karen Woodward would say, he was in Pretty in Pink.
Yes, that's true. He was the father.
The most unlikely father of Molly Ringwald ever.
That's true.
Remind me to slap your mother.
It's been a really bad year for actors and participants in the film Paris, Texas. If I was Wim Wenders, I'd like just be staying inside the rest of the year. Sam Shepard passed away earlier this year, and he wrote Paris, Texas. And of course, Harry Dean Stanton was in Paris, Texas, the film, as an actor. Wim Wenders directed it, and it won the Palme d'Or in Cannes.
He's had a cool, long career. Two documentaries, at least, were made about him, and his philosophy of life and his music. He's just an interesting old soul, and now he's gone.
Yeah, somebody who wasn't an old soul was Grant Hart of Husker Du.
Husker Du, I think, isn't it? Is it Husker? I don't know. I guess I've never really heard people say the name a lot out loud. Is it Husker Du?
I don't know, but I will tell you this. I heard Mandy Patinkin pronounced 3 times last night. Not Patinkin, Patinkin.
Oh, you're saying I have his name wrong?
I don't know. I'm just saying the Emmys pronounced it Patinkin. And I like the second time it was pronounced, I was like, aha!
Is that by Jermaine Fowler? Because he did a bad job. But yeah, Grant Hart is of Husker Du, a pioneering punk rock group from Minneapolis. He died at 56. Just a great legacy from that band and his solo work. But he was the yin to Bob Mould's yang. Bob Mould was sort of the angry John Lennon, and Grant Hart was sort of the sunnier Paul, all buried in a wall of noise, mind you. A loud band, but underneath all that feedback were some terrific melodies, and Grant Hart was a big part of that. They traded off songs, had a really bitter breakup for that band, very sad. just in the last like few months, they've actually been able to get a few things done just to release like an old EP of live music. I mean, they really, the albums have never been remastered. They can't get along. Very sad, to the point where there was a tribute show to Grant Hart before he died, and he played at it. It was his last public appearance as a performer, and Bob Mould didn't even show for that. I mean, they really did not like each other, but he was gay, Bob Mould was gay, Husker Du is a great band, and, you know, Mould had some nice things to say, saying how when they fought, it was because they cared, and he paid a good tribute to him. He said, you know, his passing was not unexpected, his deepest condolences to everyone, calling him a frighteningly talented musician. Everyone touched by his spirit will always remember. And I'm sure that people who love the band immediately said, hey, Alexa, play Husker Du.
And now people's Alexas are playing that.
Oh, Husker Du, says Alexa. Alexa, stop. So she says Husker Du. I just wanted to find that out. But that's how she pronounces it. So I'm guessing you're right.
Oh, my goodness. So here's the question. I mean, 56 is rather young. Did he have cancer or what?
Yes, he had an. I forget what the actual illness was, but yeah, he had. It wasn't a car accident. He didn't kill himself, thank God. It was an illness. We knew it for a while. It's been like a several month vigil, wake for him as people knew that he wasn't going to. Yeah, he did in fact die of cancer. So very sad news. Great talent. Cool band. One of the really pioneering outfits of Minneapolis.
Well, we're saying goodbye to Grant Hart. I'm going to listen to some of Husker Du's music now as soon as we wrap up the show, which it is time to wrap up the show. And I'd like to thank Ann Thompson of IndieWire for joining us to talk about the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals. Now, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show, subscribe to it, rate and review it. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can follow us or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's candyapplegray.com.
Wow, that must have something to do with Husker Du.
It most certainly does. And don't forget, folks, no show next week because Sperling doesn't love you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post, where you can find some of his coverage, or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.